The level of social isolation is more severe now than it was 40 years ago for the black poor. Because the black poor are more segregated now in this regard. 40 years ago, it was simply black versus white segregation. Now, not only is it black versus white, it's black versus white plus black versus middle class black. The black poor are more segregated in 2008 than they were in 1968, because at least you had a black middle class that was in the hood with you. Now they're gone. So the isolation is more severe now than it was when King dies.
So it wasn't so much that the vision was pointless. It's what we've done with that vision.
Well, this is the thing. See, King comes along when there's no Oprah, there's no Michael Jordan, there's no Jay-Z, right? So while there may be some iconic or symbolic significance of King, and we play the 30-second bite, part of what the intelligentsia has to do is say, okay, we've been working this thing, King thing, for 40 years. What's the new paradigm? What's the new paradigm? What's the new symbol? What's the new voice? What's the new sound? What is the morally arresting image that has applicability to a new epoch? Because when the United States can elect a black man president of the United States, the political metaphor of the promised land is a more complicated metaphor. Because, dude, if your group of people who were formerly slaves can develop a coalition that elects a black man whose name is Barack Hussein Obama post 9/11, dude, that's as much promised land as you're going to get. If King were to come back today, the same King of 40 years ago, he would say, well, you got black elected officials everywhere. Say, oh, my God, that's very good. Clap, applause, right? He'd do that for about 10 minutes. Then he'd say, now, King, what about the ones that got left in the ghettos? And he would, in that same spirit, be talking to the young brothers. Many people have seen the TV show The Wire. King would be out there in the streets with one of the characters in the movie, right? Stringer Bell and Barksdale, trying to figure out how to get those brothers out of selling drugs. He'd be dealing with the gang leaders. He'd be dealing with the drug dealers. That's what King would be doing today. And it's because, you'll note, King dies organizing garbage collectors. You can't be much lower on the totem pole of occupational status than being a dude who collects garbage. 40 years later, that garbage collector would probably be some young brother who's slinging drugs out here trying to make a go of it.
It seems that you've got tremendous respect for Dr. King, but you're not putting him up on a pedestal. You're lifting him up as a strategist.
Yeah, absolutely. The operational metaphor in terms of expanding the King discourse is that King is leading a group of people who are trying to get out of Egypt, right? Pharaoh's the metaphor, political oppression. Your enemies are primarily external. But the new challenge is not getting out of Egypt. The new challenge for black people is getting Egypt out of them. Black people now have to figure out how to fix themselves. And for these young people who were raised in a world where, you know, it's pimps and hoes, hip hop, now the challenge is how do we get the values, the misogyny, the disinterest in literacy, the breakdown of the black family? And see, that's where the forward thinking is. So the new politics is really the paradigm of how do we get the Egypt out of black America. It's about how do we now improve? How do we get black boys to do well in school? How do we get black kids to do well in school? And how do we get black people freed from the addictions and the habits and the culture that undermines themselves?
Would y'all agree with Reverend Rivers? He said that if Martin actually came down and looked, you know, at the state of black America right now, do you think he'd be disappointed?
Yes.
So how did we get to where we are now?
I think people are scared.
Like, of what?
I don't know, like scared to do things they want to do. They like taking shortcuts. Here, like education, people are thinking like, oh, that's too hard to do. Dang, man, have to study every day. And once another person hear about like weed and drugs and like I got $150 a week selling this weed, this little bag, they'd be like, oh, that's much easier than doing education. Like, they'll just zip right through the doors and start selling those things. And at the end, you're going to end up in jail and thinking about, dang, if I really went to school, did the right thing, then I wouldn't be in this mess.
The bottom line is, these kids are remarkably talented. They just deserve a shot. That's it. You know, I mean, you know, and for the American public, nobody's asking for a special favor. What these young people said, we want democracy. We want equality and democracy because that's the promise of America. And the black community, as never before, has to now take responsibility for itself. Right? You got your black president. Praise the Lord. So you people are happy. God bless you. Now, you better rebuild your communities.
Reverend Rivers believes that the Ella Baker House can help the next generation in the Four Corners neighborhood break the cycle of poverty and isolation. Writer and comedian Paul Mooney is still reveling in the fact that America will have a black president. For him, this MLK Day in the year of Barack Obama has been a long time coming.
I live to see this. I've always wanted this.
Mooney was a college student in the 60s, and King, well, he represented hope.
It was someone that we just, you know, was our future. We didn't know what was going to happen in the future, but that's all we had. That was back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
I can die with a smile now. It's going to be the best. This is a dream come true.
Whether you know his name or not, you know Paul Mooney's work. His comedy career has spanned nearly 50 years, writing for Sanford and Son, Saturday Night Live, The Dave Chappelle Show, tackling race in ways that are usually considered too edgy for mainstream America, until the next round, when he pushes it even further.
White means everything in America. If I brought a white baby up here, put wings on it, all of you go, oh, look at the angel. I brought a little nappy-haired black one, oh, look at the bat. Everything changes.
I'm like a great white shark. I will come after you in 2 feet of water. You'll think you're safe, but you're not safe. I'm telling you what the truth is. Whether you like it or not, that's too bad.
Over 30 years ago, when our current inauguration was just a dream, Mooney and Richard Pryor created this sketch for The Richard Pryor Show, The Black President. Here's an excerpt. Pryor is at the presidential lectern holding a press conference.
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. President, on your list of candidates for director of the FBI, are you including the name of Huey Newton?
Yes, I figure that Huey Newton is best qualified. He knows the ins and outs of the FBI. If anybody knows the ins and outs, and he would be an excellent director.
Yo, blind.
Huey Newton was a leader in the Black Panther Party, a controversial African-American organization established to promote black power through acts of social agitation. And, of course, they did have run-ins with the FBI. During the 2008 election season, Mooney was in Harlem near Sylvia's, the legendary soul food restaurant, as Barack Obama was on the campaign trail.
I was on 125th. He was coming out of Sylvia's with Al Sharpton, who says he's 53. His hairdo's 53. But anyway, he was coming out of the restaurant with Al and the FBI, the CIA, the National Guard, and the Boy Scouts. Everybody came out with him. And I was across the street, and he hollered my name out.
Wait, said, Sharpton or Obama?
Obama. Huh? Paul Mooney. It freaked me out. He screamed my name out, and I crossed the street, and I met him. It was deja vu. It reminded me of when I met President Kennedy. He had that same charisma, the same aura, same everything. And he tried to shake my hand, and I said, no, don't give me that white man's handshake. Pound, pound. That is history. I made him pound.
Do you think your comedy is going to change in this Obama era?
No. Honey, please. Race is going nowhere. I don't care if you have a half African or a half kangaroo. It doesn't change it. America's going to be America.
Yeah. Your point often has been that race means everything in America.
Yeah, it does. That's why when I see a homeless white person, I start crying. What a waste of white skin.
You don't have the same reaction when you see a black homeless person?
No, no.
Why?
No, I just don't. We know how to be poor. What are you talking about? Talking about this recession. What they do, call us? We've always ate beans and rice. Come on.
So, yeah, I don't think it's a...
And Obama loves to tell jokes. If Obama
He's very funny.
If Obama tells another joke, I'm going to have to run for president. He's
right?
Messing in my backyard.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to have to get in his. I was if you tell one more joke, I'm going to have to run for president.
Would you run against him?
I'm going to have to if he keeps telling jokes. He's giving me competition.
I know you've made a couple jokes about Martin Luther King Jr., but are there some people that you just don't touch? Can you make Dr. King funny? Really, really funny?
Yeah. I mean, anybody can be made fun of. For a comedian's view? Mm-hmm. Yeah, anyone. No one's safe. Mm. Nobody is. Not even the Pope. Nobody's safe.
Do you consider your work, your life's work, a part of the civil rights movement?
I'm a comedian first and last. The other part just happens. It takes on its own life. People are shocked by some things I say. I'm shocked. It comes from God. I don't like sit and plan it and write it and I'm going to do this. It just happens. And it's
but
my,
it comes from somewhere. You well, said
I,
yourself.
I, but
you
I know, said it comes
you,
from God. It doesn't come from me.
I'm not that
funny.
Watch.
But I'm not that funny. God is funny.
Okay. But you're using your whatever gift God gave you as he's speaking through you
yeah.
as a way to comment on some real serious stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And you were working like right in the thick of the civil rights movement.
Yeah. And when I was in junior college, Martin Luther King came and they said, you all have to meet Paul Mooney. It was unreal meeting Martin Luther King. I mean, he was bright. He was short, but he was bright and very friendly. That was back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, back in the day.
And clearly Martin wanted to meet you.
Well, the people at the school, white and black, told him he had to meet me.
Now, why did they? Why did he
Because
have to
I was
meet
like
you?
A rebel. I mean, I was like...
You were the revolutionary.
At school...
How was your comedy
okay,
revolutionary?
Here it was a school. Me and a German friend, an Asian. I started a club called the IRs, interracial. Anybody that wanted to be out of their race that wanted to be together. And one day, the lily white little kids were talking about their fraternities and their sororities that were all white. And they were saying the reason they didn't have them integrated is because mixing caused it mixed dating. And mixed dating meant mixed marriage and mixed kids. And they didn't want that.
Oh, no.
And I said, but this is a state college. I said, you can't do that. That's discrimination. They said, well, there's nothing you can do about it. I said, really? So the next day I came to school and I told all the Asians, I told all the blacks, and I told all the whites that liked the blacks, boycott, and told the football players to beat anybody up that tried to cross the picket line, and I protested.
And who'd you learn that from?
Martin Luther King. And it worked, and we won. And they had to get off the campus if they didn't integrate the fraternities and sororities.
Hot dog!
Mm-hmm. That's why they wanted Martin to meet me.
I knew you were a revolutionary.
I'm that. Oh, yeah.
Comedian Paul Mooney. Coming up, we'll talk with Dolores Huerta, co-founder of the United Farm Workers of America, to find out what it's like to continue the work after the leader is gone. And we'll hear about a new musical composition in honor of Dr. King. Stay tuned for more on The Promised Land, a public radio special. I'm Majora Carter. I'm Majora Carter, and welcome back to The Promised Land. Today, we're honoring Martin Luther King Jr. by looking at the many ways he influences visionaries today. For many who were alive at the time, King's death was a profound shock, the kind that makes people remember precisely where they were when they heard the news. In 1968, Dolores Huerta was a leader with the United Farm Workers.
Actually, I was in New York when I heard about the assassination. It was just terrible. I was really fortunate to be part of the march in Memphis after Dr. King was killed. Nobody spoke during that march. Everybody was quiet. The only thing you could hear were the sounds of the feet hitting the pavement. And by the way, as we were marching, they had National Guardsmen that were lining the streets, and they had their rifles pointed at the crowd. And then every other corner, they had these big tanks. They had tanks, again, with the cannons pointed at the crowd.
What happens after a charismatic leader like MLK dies? It's a huge blow, not only for the loss of a person, but can a movement reinvent itself without the figure at its core? Dolores Huerta, who is now 78, knows this problem as well as anyone. Along with Cesar Chavez, Huerta founded the United Farm Workers in 1962. Together, they ran the UFW through the years of some of its greatest triumphs in the struggle for the rights of agricultural workers. But after Cesar died in 1993, she had to chart a whole new direction for the movement.
You know, Cesar's parents lived to be 100 years old, both his mother and his dad. And so we all thought Cesar would live forever, practically. We never really talked too much about what would happen if anything would happen to him. He always assumed that I would take over the leadership of the union. But, you know, Cesar always said, when people would ask him, what will happen to this union after you're gone? And he would say, if I didn't think the union would continue after my death, he says, I never would have began the union in the first place.
Well, there's definitely this perception that he was this saint-like figure. But what was he really like?
Well, people talk about him being a charismatic figure. He really wasn't. Cesar was not a flamboyant or a great speaker, say, like Obama. Cesar was the kind of a person that attracted attention, not so much about the way he carried himself, but mostly about what he did. So he was actually a pretty quiet individual and extremely, extremely intelligent. But he had a great sense of humor. He was just a lot of fun. You know, he would always, whenever we'd have meetings, he'd like to play like these parlor games, you know, where everybody would get involved. And
this is not what most people think about.
No.
Cesar Chavez played parlor games?
Oh, yeah, he loved to play parlor games. And looking back, it was just a kind of way of team building, you might say now, but it was very much a part of his nature, you know.
Well, yeah. After he died, what changed about the way you worked?
Well, the whole culture of the organization changed. You know, when Cesar was alive, he had some very strong precepts. One of them was that none of the staff should ever earn more than what a farm worker earns. And so we didn't really earn any wages. We got our rent paid. We pretty much lived on donations. But then after Cesar passed away, then the wages went up considerably to be more competitive with other labor unions. Also, Cesar believed very much in community. We all ate together at least one meal a day, and that was also changed. So the whole culture of the organization pretty much changed, becoming more of a traditional union than the type of a movement union that we had when Cesar was alive.
Are there times when you wish you could consult Cesar Chavez now?
Well, you know, we worked together for so many, many years that I kind of knew the way he thinks, you know? And, yeah, I do miss Cesar in terms of being able to get that feedback and to argue, you know, because we would argue back and forth, sometimes very heated discussions. People around us thought that we were enemies. But at the end of the quote-unquote fighting, he'd pick up the phone, I'd pick up the phone, and we'd be back on track, you know, because we're both Aries, and we'd both get very heated up, and then we would forget about it, you know. And sometimes he was right, and sometimes I was right. And that was the great thing about it.
You're 78 years old now, and a great-great-grandmom. Why do you keep working, and as a community organizer to boot? Not the easiest job in the world.
Well, we have to, because we have so many challenges that we have to meet. And the main thing, and you have to kind of remind people that they have power. And I say to people, when we started organizing the farm workers, people would say to us, how are you going to organize these workers? You know, they're poor, they don't speak English, they're immigrants. How are you ever going to get them together to form a union? And so many people even said, you can never do it. But the way that we did it is convince them that they have power and that the power is in themselves, that they can come together like Dr. King did with the Civil Rights Movement, with the marches and with the boycotts and, you know, going to jail. And so I think this is my mission as an organizer, is to convince people that they have power and that they can make the changes, that they've got to confront government, and we've got to make our public officials accountable, and we've got to take over government, you know, so that we can spread this message of democracy, basically, and of being able to use our power that we have as human beings.
In 2002, Dolores Huerta left the United Farm Workers and started the Dolores Huerta Foundation. She continues to work today, supporting organizing efforts for agricultural workers and a variety of community issues. It's one thing to have to carry on the legacy of a leader, but what if you actually share the name of Dr. King? What would that be like? And if you search our nation's phone books, it turns out that there are many Martin Luther Kings across the country, everywhere from Madison, Wisconsin, to Milton, Florida, to Yuma, Arizona. And yes, when you start calling them, you get a lot of dead ends.
We're sorry, you have reached a number that has been disconnected.
Not everyone is enthused about the comparison to MLK. After you reach a few, you realize having this name can carry a lot of weight. From Ellenwood, Georgia, I spoke with a trucker named Martin. He told me the name inspired him to care just a little bit more about the people in need.
It kind of keeps me in check a little bit. I guess it stays in the back of my head, what he did and how he reached out to people. And I guess I feel I have to do somewhat of the same.
What do you mean by that?
Well, he sacrificed himself for the good of others. And I guess sometimes I'll be doing the same thing.
So there's got to be some crazy things that happened to you given your name.
I was fortunate enough to go overseas and represent the U.S. in martial arts. When they found out my name, they received me well, even in Korea. People asked my name, and they just stared at me. I thought, oh, I may not live to make it back home. But then when they said, oh, the Martin King, and they hugged me, and they shook my hand, and they treated me some grass. I'm not him. They said, we know, but that name. That was just at odds with me, that even in Korea, South Korea, that they really respected this man of peace.
I learned that the name doesn't always mean a free pass, however. This Martin, from Madison, Wisconsin, said he often hears disbelief at first.
You're lying. Yeah, right.
Really?
Yeah.
Even still, he's passed along the name Martin Luther King to his 7-year-old son.
I wanted my name just to be carried on, you know. I'm my own person, you know, I'm me. You know, I'm not trying to be like anybody else.
Some MLKs have found the name can actually be a problem. Say when you find yourself maybe in a bit of trouble with the law.
And I told the man that my name was Martin Luther King and I lived on Martin Luther King Drive. He thought I was lying.
Oh, no, so that got you into more trouble.
I had to go to court and pay $250 like everybody else.
In Longview, Texas, this Martin Luther King has been a minister for 26 years.
I knew Martin Luther King. I knew about him. But the way my life went, the way his went, I didn't know the common bond that we would have. When I think and I look at my children, when you out there fighting for a cause, he could be comfortable just taking care of himself, but instead, he put his life on the line, his children in danger, his wife in danger, and I look at mine, I'm at awe.
To check out a project documenting the many MLK streets around the country, visit thepromisedland.org. In the 40 years since his death, Martin Luther King has inspired countless artists. In 2003, John Walker wrote a poem dedicated to King and passed it on to his longtime friend and collaborator, composer David Conte. The result is The Homecoming, a 6-minute musical poem for 12 voices. The Homecoming was commissioned and performed here by the well-known all-male singing group Chanticleer. It evokes Dr. King and his political struggle in metaphors of color, prison, and deliverance. It's not exactly a typical protest song, but then it's not meant to be. Composer David Conte and writer John Walker say they were inspired by Dr. King and the fight for dignity for all human beings. The Homecoming is their manifestation of these beliefs. John Walker says the words came to him in a flash while he was working in Norway as a caretaker in a community for people with disabilities.
I was in Norway in a little tiny community on the coast, on the western coast of Norway, surrounded by this incredible natural beauty and at the same time by a community of individuals who have as an interest in the world to make being disabled part of human life in a way that isn't isolated from human life, so that the people we were caregivers for were included in the community as equals. Mm. I had a feeling in this environment, I guess, especially about matters of justice and the situation of the oppressed. And it's hard to describe the inner experience of inspiration, but it was as though the poem were there and had to come out. It felt like it had to be put on paper. Mm. The title is The Homecoming. Color where in jail you're on fire, with the heart of thousands, with the heart of millions. Color it with azure for the skies of the heavens. Make them ring with the cries of the birds who call them home. Color it with verdure for the trees of the earth. Make them sing with the shrieks of the apes who call them home. Color it with ardor for the spirits of men. Make them cower with the wrath of their gods who call them home. Color where in jail you're on fire with the heart of the god they abandoned. Color it with apocalyptic purity, with white for the wombs of the mothers. Make them shine with the salve of the babes who called them home. The babes from whose mouths shall pour forth the words that quench the fire and set you free and call you home.
Is to color is all over this poem.
Yeah.
Why talk in terms of colors?
Well, there you go. I mean, we have our rainbow flag, right? And its associations with diversity, also with the legacy of Martin Luther King as Jesse Jackson came to represent it, his Rainbow Coalition. It's really, to me, not a cliche and not a political slogan to recognize that color is a manifestation of light's love in a certain sense of nature. And in nature, we have diversity of the most stunning kind. So for me, everything that a man like King, and I have to say others as well, individuals who committed themselves to the real, truly to Gandhi, to the well-being of humankind, there's a quality of awareness in such individuals, it seems to me, of this love, light as an expression of something very real that's illuminating, that conveys truth.
Right.
There are values in the rainbow idea if we don't just let it become a slogan.
And the poem is so full of imagery that evokes the civil rights movement and Dr. King. You know, jail and fire, this sense of yearning for justice and for hope.
Yeah.
Did you have something more specific in mind? Was there, by any chance?
Well, I had the image of him in Birmingham jail. That was my specific image of King, as many others in history who've tried to serve the common good, welfare of humanity, end up imprisoned or the like. So that image was the initial impetus.
Now, David, you've said about John's text, now quote, "A soul who is restless and angry that the justice Dr. King dreamed of has not yet come to pass."
Yes. I was very much inspired by this image. And, of course, when John and I worked together, I talked to him about the poem, and he directed me to two specific things that King said that seemed to sum up the spirit that John was just talking about. And if I could, I'll just read this sentence. King said, "If the inexpressible cruelties of slavery could not stop us, the opposition we now face will surely fail. We will win our freedom because the sacred heritage of our nation and the eternal will of God are embodied in our echoing demands." So that really sums up the passion of his feeling for his cause, and whatever music I write comes into being completely because of the words and the color of the words and the tone and who the speaker is of the particular text and to whom they're speaking. These are all things that inspire me and help me find my way to the notes that I choose.
Can you think of any moments in the piece where the tone does do that? Something musical where it does create some of those colors?
Well, I like to think that every tone of the piece does it.
Give me one of your favorites.
Well, the piece is about 6 minutes long, and if you noticed about John's poem, it mentions images in succession in each verse, and then in the very last verse, they kind of pile up.
Yes.
Like, so you have the babes from whose mouths shall pour forth the words that quench the fire and set you free and call you home. And I had a solo voice just sing the last line, and call you home. And the chord, that the very last chord of the piece, after much dissonance or struggle, comes to rest. And I have, every time I've heard the piece with an audience, I feel the whole room come to rest.
Chanticleer is now performing The Homecoming around the U.S. David Conte and John Walker have since begun work on their next project, a piece about Abraham Lincoln. Coming up, we'll hear from Dr. Vincent Harding, a dear friend of Martin Luther King, who wrote some of his most famous speeches. And we'll visit with Judy Bonds in the coal country of West Virginia, an amazing woman who was inspired by many of Dr. King's words. Stay tuned for more of The Promised Land, a special series exploring visionaries from around the world and around the corner. I'm Majora Carter. I'm Majora Carter, and you're listening to The Promised Land. Vincent Harding, an activist and scholar, lived with his wife around the corner from the Kings in Atlanta and spent a lot of time with MLK in the 1960s. The Hardings had come from Chicago to work in the civil rights movement. They were Mennonites who traveled south to teach nonviolent direct action. Harding is sometimes described as King's speechwriter, but he prefers to be considered a friend who knew King's thoughts well and was ready to help in any capacity when Martin was overwhelmed by all his other responsibilities. They would talk about lots of things, recalls Harding, including the Vietnam War. Their back and forth about this war led to one of Martin Luther King's most powerful statements, his anti-Vietnam War speech delivered at New York City's Riverside Church in 1967.
And it became clear to me that the war was doing far more than devastating the hopes of the poor at home. It was sending their sons and their brothers and their husbands to fight and to die in extraordinarily high proportions relative to the rest of the population. We were taking the black young men who had been crippled by our society and sending them 8,000 miles away to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in Southwest Georgia and East Holland.
King was expanding his reach and his direction. He realized that for democracy to flourish, there had to be a coming together of all people who were suffering. Poor whites, blacks, Latinos, Asians, Native Americans. He was concerned that the burden of warfare unfairly impacted poor communities of all colors across our country. The Poor People's Campaign occupied the last months of King's life. In March of 1968, King held a summit in Atlanta that brought together 78 leaders, including Native Americans, a representative of United Farm Workers, coal miners, and many, many more. Vincent Harding was there in that room with those 78 leaders.
What I remember more than anything else was some earnest, honest struggle going on in the lives and hearts of many of the non-black people there, asking themselves, am I ready to follow the leadership of this black man in moving my people and this country onto a real campaign against poverty?
Wow.
Unfortunately, Martin's assassination broke that movement. But in a way, you could say that what we are seeing on January 20th, 2009, could be a picking up again among many of us who know that we need to deal with poverty in America. We need to deal with the things that King said, what he called the triple evils: racism, materialism, and militarism.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, we have an opportunity now, and we need to figure out whether this beautiful moment in Americans' life will be a time when we can catch up with him.
Right. So at the end of his life, I mean, he was clearly thinking toward the future. I mean, I would even dare say, you know, as far as he was pushing toward economic justice for all, and he was killed in Memphis, Tennessee, working with the sanitation workers. And so what we have is someone who is incredibly forward-thinking.
Majora, isn't it fantastic and beautiful, even though sadness is wrapped into it, that a PhD in philosophy or philosophical theology should offer his life on behalf of garbage workers?
Mm.
It seems to me that that is a powerful challenge, especially when all of the last 2 years of our political campaigns have acted as if the middle class is the only class to be cared about in America.
Mm-hmm.
Here was a man who went to garbage workers and said, I am with you.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in this program, we've spoken to organizers for the United Farm Workers, comedians, poets, and composers, and they do all feel like Dr. King was an inspiration for them. And some even feel like they're actually continuing his work.
Yes.
What do you say to folks who say that it's sort of, he doesn't really serve that much of a purpose right now, and he's not that relevant right now?
Well, it depends upon how seriously people look at what he was talking about. If we wrap him up in some small space called I Have a Dream, or some small space called civil rights for Negroes, then he's obviously not relevant. But he never lived in that small space. He was always opening up a larger space. That's why he was reaching out at the end of his life to all the folks he possibly could. And the question is, are we ready to reach out at least as far as he was reaching out? And thereby, are we ready to become relevant?
Vincent Harding. Back in 1968, Judy Bonds was a young girl growing up poor and white in the coal mining communities of West Virginia, as her family had for the previous seven generations. But Martin Luther King's message managed to reach her there in ways that had stayed with her ever since. For over a decade, she has fought against mountaintop removal coal mining, using strategies rooted in Dr. King's civil rights work.
It had to be peaceful. That was the number one thing we learned from King, was that nonviolence is the only way. Violence begets violence.
So how big is this community here?
We're going up to Hell's Gate right now. And you can see Coal River Mountain. This time of the year when the leaves are dropping, you can see the lay of the land, the swags and the gaps. And it looks like God stuck his hand down and, you know, just formed them.
Judy stretches her arm toward the skyline. These mountains are sacred to her. We're near Whitesville, West Virginia, about an hour from the state capital, and this is her home.
Judy's the eighth generation of her family from here and can't imagine living anywhere else. But these once familiar mountains are disappearing, along with the environmental benefits the mountain's ecosystem used to provide.
It's the last mountain in this valley that has been untouched by the mining industry.
According to Judy, contemporary coal mining methods involve using massive amounts of explosives to remove hundreds of feet off the tops of Appalachian mountains, allowing easy access to the coal below. This practice is destroying communities in West Virginia. Her goal is to stop mountaintop removal completely. Mountaintop removal pollutes local water sources. Polluted water leads to increased rates of illness and disease, not to mention the destruction of an entire ecosystem. Without trees and topsoil, extensive flooding has led some West Virginia counties to be designated federal disaster areas. Damages have topped $95 million, but the losses experienced by local people are impossible to assess.
Here's the coal.
Wait, oh, so we've been walking all over them.
You've been walking all over it this whole time.
Oh, my. It's quite beautiful.
You ought to see it in the spring. The greening of the hills. You do feel protected.
Really?
And hugged.
Incredibly. Oh, dear God.
Yeah.
And I did feel protected until we reached an abrupt end to the trail.
Oh, my God. There was a mountain here.
There was a mountain here. Looked just like that mountain there. You see what man's done?
It is as though the very life of this area has just been like ripped off, and you feel it. And it is the kind of color gray that reminds you of death.
What's left is a massive, gray, lifeless pit. It's like a lunar landscape. We've come on a weekend. Heavy, earth-moving trucks sit idle, but Judy shows me where they're beginning to work on a nearby mountain.
They go in and they take all the trees off of the mountain. They destroy all the forest there, and a lot of time they just push them over the side of the hill and burn them. And then they bring a huge drill in, which drills holes in the ground, and they stuff ammonium nitrate, that's diesel fuel and fertilizer, down in it. And then they set the charge off and blow it up, and they haul it off and back up to the edge of the mountain and just dump it. And then they go back and they haul the rest of it until they get to the coal seam. Then they go back and they blast another layer. It's like a layer cake to them.
Yeah.
Judy Bonds works in Whitesville, West Virginia, a town that the last census reported as 99.23% white. In Judy's home, a poster with the words of Martin Luther King hangs on the wall.
Toward the end of King's career, you know, he knew. He got it. He was beginning to talk to sanitation workers. He knew what the future looked like for us all, and he knew it was time to take it a step further now. He got it. And that's why he's no longer with us. And when he said, "I may not get there with you," I knew then, cold chills went up my arm. I knew then he knew what was going to happen to him. And that's why they assassinated King. They knew he got it.
And like King, Judy's work comes with a certain level of danger. She's received threats to her life and to her home. She pays attention to who parks beside her and who follows her out of a store. At home, a couple of guns are kept ready for self-defense.
I've been around guns all my life. That's a .22 Magnum. It don't leave a big hole, but we have a 20-gauge, you know, over there that leaves a really big place on you.
The threats have increased. Her daughter was accosted by a local teacher at the Dairy Queen and by a neighbor at a local convenience store. But none of this convinces Judy to look elsewhere for a place to live. Winding down one of the area's remaining mountains, we encounter a coal truck coming back our way. He pulls aside.
It's a courtesy, you know what I mean? See, he's got these green stripes on. I waved at him. He's not going to wave at me.
What do the green stripes mean?
He's going to work and blowing up a mountain.
So that guy totally knows who you are.
He totally knows who I am. He totally knows.
Judy Bond's father was a coal miner. Her grandfather was one, and her great-grandfather, too. Most people in this community have some connection to coal. Its presence is everywhere.
A coal truck. It's about to pass through the gate leading to your homeland.
Yeah. Yeah. I was the last person to move out of that holler.
In 1994, Morpha Cole opened up at a mountain above the holler where Judy's family lived. She was working as a clerk at a local convenience store, and one day stands out in her memory, a particular moment when she knew something had to be done.
My daughter, my grandson, and I were walking, and Andrew wanted to get in the creek and play, so he did. And it wasn't long, you know, we heard, "Hey, hey, what's wrong with these fish?" We looked down, and there he stood in a stream full of dead fish floating all around him, and he had his little chubby, beautiful hands full of dead fish. And that's when I realized something's wrong here. Then it wasn't but about 2 weeks later that I watched black water just roll down past my house at that stream. Mm. And then I realized they're poisoning the whole town of Whitesville.
Whitesville once boasted 6 churches, 2 movie theaters, and a bowling alley. Today, the town is quiet. Judy says the decline came when mining companies shifted from traditional underground mining to strip mining, which needs far fewer workers. Since the 1950s, 90% of the coal miners in West Virginia have lost their jobs. Here, in a former post office building, is the Coal River Mountain Watch, where Judy is the co-director. There's a mural of green mountains painted on the outside. Inside, it's Activist Central, with flyers, bins of T-shirts, posters, and on a shelf, there are several glass jars of colored water. Gray, tan, black. It looks like an amateur science lab.
This came from Mary Pauley from Printers Hot Water Tank. Sludge leached into
this came from...
Coal River Mountain Watch takes quarterly samples of the water in the area and responds when people call up and say something doesn't look quite right in their water. The specimens are all local, but Judy's vision is big.
This little stream out here is the big Coal River, and it flows into the Kanawha River, which flows into the Ohio River, which flows into the Mississippi River, which goes to the Gulf of Mexico. So when they pollute my water, they pollute your water too.
It seems to me that you're not just fighting for your little section, your holler, but it's way, way, way bigger than that. And it does remind me of the civil rights movement, period. You know, that it's about injustice anywhere is a threat to justice anywhere.
Anywhere.
Obviously, that's one of the most famous sayings that King put out
Absolutely.
There.
And the movement of the 60s had a profound effect on me and pride in the fact that we can overcome things.
Over 40 years since King's death, the civil rights movement remains alive in this Appalachian community. 2005 was the first year of Mountain Justice Summer, a coalition of groups that came together to raise awareness about mountaintop removal and its effects on the people and the environment. For inspiration, they looked to Mississippi Freedom Summer in 1964, when over 1,000 out-of-state volunteers came to Mississippi to help with local voter registration.
So we used that model to bring people from all over America into Appalachia to make a connection about energy uses and blowing up mountains. You know, this is what's amazing. People here in West Virginia, the powers that be, the media, and the people that are politicians use the same language to try to keep people out of Appalachia as they did to try to keep people out of Mississippi.
What were some of the things they said?
Oh, these people are coming to stir up trouble, to bring about crazy ideas. And then they started saying, oh, these aren't nothing but hippies, which is what they said in Mississippi Freedom Summer, too. There you go again, bringing in those troublemakers.
Well, she's yellow.
Where is she? Hey, Dixie. Hey, Dixie.
Judy Bond still finds peace at home, even if she has to keep surveillance cameras trained on it. She lives with her daughter and her grandson. Her dogs Dixie and Dusty join her out back by the river. She says it helps her maintain her sanity.
You know, I am who I am. I'm my mother's daughter, and, you know, we fight for what we believe in. Because if you don't fight for what you believe in today, when your child looks at you 10 years from now and says, Mommy, when all this was going on, why didn't you do something? It's not like that what we're doing is not going to go down in history, because it is. It's already going down in history.
basically, I would like for my descendants to look back and say, wow, Grandma raised hell, and she did something.
You can see photos of my trip to West Virginia with Judy Bonds at thepromisedland.org. Looking back at Martin Luther King 40 years after he's gone, it's sometimes hard to remember he was a human being whose ideas were constantly evolving. New voices have come forward to continue the work that he was known for, and Dr. King continued the work of those who came before him. Maybe someday there will be a time when there is no distance between where we are and where we ought to be when it comes to equality. But we still have a long way to go. In 2009, we do have a black president, and this is a tremendous step towards reaching the promised land that I believe in. But it's hardly the end of our journey together. The people we talk to embodied a diversity of ideas on how they're getting to their promised land. The ability to dream didn't start with MLK, but he was one of those crucial leaders who reminds us that our dreams are achievable and that the biggest dreams of all live beyond our short time on this earth. I am so thankful to have the opportunity to bring you these voices, and I am really looking forward to the next time when we meet again on the Promised Land. To continue the conversation, or to tell us what your promised land looks like, leave us a message at 888-RADIO-55. That's 888-723-4655. Or email us at share@thepromisedland.org. Also on our website, thepromisedland.org, you'll find more information and photos of our guests. Stay tuned for more news on our upcoming Earth Day special. The Promised Land was produced by Launch Minneapolis with Marge Ostrushko, executive producer, Emily Botine, and Ben Shapiro, producers. Our program was edited by Mary Beth Kirshner with production help from Emily Torgrimson and Posey Gruner. Scott Liebers was our engineer, Stevie Beck the research writer, and James Chase was the editorial consultant. Thanks to Chris Bannon, Lynn Clendenin, Aaron Cohen, Maxie Jackson, Ingrid Lakey, and Paul Rue Est. The Promised Land was made possible by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Majora Carter.
WILL programs are made possible in part by Bevere Cafe, offering breakfast from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. and lunches from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. Monday through Friday, and catering. Bevere Cafe is student-operated on the second floor of Bevere Hall, corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana.
Today on Martin Luther King Day, we'll repeat two locally produced documentaries. At 1, Hear Our Journey, Stories of School Desegregation and Community in Champaign-Urbana, produced in 2004 by girls from Franklin Middle School. Then at 2, you'll hear Competing Against Discrimination, Achieving Equality in Athletics at the University of Illinois, produced last year by students from Urbana University High School. Tune in for these programs this afternoon from 1 to 3.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from St. John's Catholic Newman Center at the University of Illinois. Serving over 10,000 Catholic students, St. John's is dedicated to the spiritual needs and development of students, faculty, and staff at UIUC and Parkland College. Learn more on the web at sjcnc.org.
It's 1 minute before 12 noon. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL 580 AM. And 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana. I'm Jeff Bossert. We'll have the normal noon hour of programming for the Afternoon Magazine. And then, as mentioned a moment ago, we'll have the two specials in accordance with today's Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. Let's look at the forecast for Illinois and Indiana from AM 580's Mike Sola. A lake effect snow advisory is in effect for portions of northern Indiana today. And this afternoon in the south, mostly sunny in northwest and north central Indiana, mostly cloudy with areas of lake effect snow. Elsewhere, increasing clouds with scattered flurries and a few snow showers arriving. Highs ranging from around 15 in far northwest Illinois to 35 in southwestern Illinois. Tonight in northern Indiana, cloudy with localized snow squalls and snow showers. Elsewhere, partly to mostly cloudy with scattered snow flurries and showers. Lows ranging from around 5 in northeast Indiana to 20 in southwestern.